Hi, I'm Ken Harbaugh, former U.S. Navy pilot and host of Warriors in Their Own Words. Our mission here is simple, to preserve stories of service and sacrifice from America's warriors. Through archival interviews with veterans from World War II up through modern-day conflicts, we present firsthand accounts of what it takes to defend a nation. This is the unvarnished, unsanitized truth from those who lived it. This is Warriors in Their Own Words.
We'd been living on rice for 30 days and tea. And when we came through, that Marine regiment just ran us right through their chow line. They happened, as we were coming in, they were getting ready to eat, and they just made way for us. They said, "Hey, Raiders, come on, eat." And boy, did we pig out. Their food just tasted like it was the greatest food that ever existed.
Today, we'll hear from William Lansford. Lansford served in World War II with the Marine Raiders, a special ops force that specialized in amphibious guerrilla warfare.
Guadalcanal had been invaded, and we were finally, we got an assignment to go into Guadalcanal and help, you know, the effort there. The Marines were very hard pressed. You know, they'd done a wonderful job, but I mean, they were virtually isolated too, fighting on nothing. We had come in to escort some army troops who were supposed to, I guess it was partly an engineer or unit, who were supposed to make a new airfield at Iola Point, you know, a distance away from, near the coastline, away from Henderson Field. And it turned out the place was a swamp. You know, the admiral who had ordered this thing was, in my view, a dumbbell, and in the view of a lot of other people. He thought he was a general, you know, and he knew best. Well, anyway, it turned out it was a swamp, so it was nothing doing. The poor army guys were just hanging around there, and the Raiders had nothing to do. Then Carlson got a call from General Vandegrift, the commander of the island, to come in and see him. That's the story as I remember, to come in and see him. And then Vandegrift and his staff asked Carlson, Tor Carlson, that intelligence indicated that a Japanese regiment, a fresh regiment, had landed just a few miles up from where we were. And could Carlson do anything to intercept them? Because they were heading for Henderson Field, and they were going to reinforce the Japanese troops there and very probably attack the Marines again and try to take the field back. And the Marines were, you know, they were hungry, they were tired. So Carlson said, okay, that he would undertake the job of intercepting this Japanese regiment. So he came back to us. And Carlson returned from conferring with the Marines there around Henderson Field and said that we had an assignment to knock out this Japanese regiment. And that's what we were going to do. And what we did, essentially, was Carlson sent for the rest of the Raiders, and we just followed the Japanese all the way from their landing point to Henderson Field, and just kept chopping and chopping and chopping at them. And it was probably I guess along with Macon Island, it was probably the job that best exemplified the kind of work that we were trying to do. And we would catch these guys, Carlson would keep track of them, you know. I was one of the scouts, and we'd keep track of where these guys were. And as soon as they started to cross a river with their equipment up, we'd hit them, bango. Carlson had developed many unorthodox, you might say, techniques, you know, combat techniques. One of them was, and he seldom gets credit for this, everybody else takes credit for it, but one of them was the fire group, which gave tremendous mobility and firepower to the Marine squads, and it's used today. The other one was extensive use of walkie-talkie radios by which the officers were able to keep, you know, the company officers were able to communicate with each other and coordinate their attacks. And consequently, we had a lot of mobility that the Japanese didn't have. And, you know, it was a whole regiment, and we were just working in teams of maybe one or two companies at the most. And we were able to hit them and then disappear into the jungle, which must have galled the Japanese because they were supposed to be the great jungle fighters. And we would hit them and disappear into the jungle, and then a few hours later, locate them and hit them again. And the result was that after 30 days of following and hitting these poor guys, the regiment ceased to exist. You know, when it arrived at its destination, it was useless. It was, and my understanding is that the colonel burned his flag and shot himself, and that was the end of that effort. General Twining, who at that time was a colonel and was the chief planner for Vandegrift and the Guadalcanal campaign, wrote in his book, I think it's called No Bended Knee, I think the book, that it was the most perfectly executed campaign of the entire Guadalcanal fight, of the entire Guadalcanal campaign. And Carlson did that. We were able to kill, you know, literally hundreds of Japanese and lose only, you know, a fraction of that in raiders. I think in one time, I think we knocked off about 50 of them at Asamana, and we lost 3 raiders there, as I recall. But the odds were always that way, you know. The Japanese were not, they didn't expect that Americans would be able to do that. But I mean, I think that justifies a whole raider effort right there. That, and of course, Edson, the first raiders, did a magnificent job on what they call Edson's Ridge, you know, defending Guadalcanal one night. He won the Medal of Honor for that. So, you know, the first raiders, you can't take it away from them either. They were doing a great job. And later on, the other raider battalions, the 3rd and 4th, one of them was headed by Jimmy Roosevelt, did a marvelous job too. The main thing was that you have to have, I think you have to have a lot of stamina. You have to be able to live on nothing. During that 30-day raid behind the Japanese lines, we literally lived on rice and tea and a little bit of bacon occasionally. That was our whole diet during that period. And Carlson had developed a system of airdropping food to us. But, you know, airdropping was a primitive thing at that time, and half the time, I think the Japanese got our food more than we did. But we would cook in our helmets, I remember. Start a little fire and put rice and water in our helmet, and if you had any bacon, you'd break up little pieces and drop it in there. And sometimes we had salt and sometimes we didn't. Each man was issued every few days, I can't remember how often, each raider was issued as much rice as he could hold in his sock up to the heel. And then we would tie the sock on our belt, I remember, and as much tea as you could, you know, hold up to the middle of the foot of the sock, you know, the foot section. And that's what we lived on, tea and rice. It wasn't a great diet. When that was left of the Japanese regiment arrived at Henderson Field, they were, you know, they were demoralized and decimated, and the regiment was essentially destroyed. And as I said, you know, I heard later on that the colonel burned his flag, the regimental flag, and shot himself. And that was it. You know, they just were useless. They just scattered, and they never made the effort again. They never were able to reinforce or make any effort against Henderson Field. And the raiders were credited with having killed at least 400 and some known enemy casualties. I think Guadalcanal was probably the defining moment for the raider technique, you know, the thing that Carlson had been wanting to do. Many of the guys in the raiders, especially in the Guadalcanal campaign, suffered, because that was a prolonged campaign, suffered from all kinds of jungle rot and ulceration and of course, you know, malaria. You know, we lived on these pills. We would take these malaria pills, Atterburn, I think it was called, and everybody would turn yellow, you know. And you know, a terrible diet. And the guys were very weak. We were just, towards the end, we were staggering around. When you took your boots off, you know, to try to wash your feet after a long march, your socks would stick to your feet, and when you pull the socks off, it would pull the ulcers off, and then your feet would start bleeding. Every day after a long march in the evenings, we would have foot inspection, and the corpsmen would come by. And those corpsmen were just, I can't say enough about the corpsmen, how great those guys are. And they would come by and they would look at our feet, and then they would say, you have to go back, you have to go back. And you know, and they would send us back through the lines. Then one day my day came, and when, you know, I took my socks off and I began bleeding, and there was bleeding blood on my boots and all that, and the corpsman said, you gotta go back now. And I said, you know, no matter what happened in the Raider Battalion, if you didn't like what happened, you could always appeal directly to Carlson, or you could appeal to Jimmy Roosevelt, which was most unusual. None of this going through the, you know, through the first sergeant and all that. You just go directly to him. So I said, I want to talk to the old man. And Carlson came up and he said, what is it, son? And I said, you know, I'm okay. I want to stay. I don't want to go back. You know, we're almost done here. And then he said, let's look at your feet. And he looked at my feet and he said, son, he said, you got to go back. I said, no, sir. You said that if we wanted to stick, we could stick. And he said, all right, let me put it to you this way. He said, what happens if your feet totally give out in the middle of the march and we're not in a position to send you back? He said, then I have to assign one or two guys to carry you, and that slows us up, and the enemy, and we're prey to the enemy. He said, do you want that to happen? I said, no. He said, put your boots on and go back. That's the way he always talked to people. He was wonderful. After the campaign, we went to New Zealand, and we're supposed to have 2 weeks of R&R. I think we had like 5 days, actually, before they called us back on something else. And Al Flores, my buddy, and another buddy, Jack Johnstone, and I can't remember, there were a couple of other guys and myself, walking down the street of New Zealand when all of a sudden a cab or whatever it was came by and backfired, and we just disappeared into the, you know, the one guy was down in the gutter and another guy was down in the stairway that went down like that. And when I looked up, there were all these ladies and, you know, the civilians looking at us like we were crazy. We had all scattered and hit the deck. That's people, you know, a lot of the guys went a little bit psycho too. Some of the guys got pretty battle happy. They, you know, they would not let go of their guns. They always had a hand grenade with them. I mean, you know, really eccentric. We didn't think we were eccentric at all. But I guess we did act weird, you know. When I was in the hospital, I kept my pistol and I kept a hand grenade with me all the time. And the doctors tried to take it away from me, and I wouldn't give it up. And they told me to get the hell out of there. They were talking about chopping off my legs because, you know, the infections were so bad. I left the hospital holding the pistol and the hand grenade. It sounds very melodramatic, but it didn't seem unnatural to me. It just seemed like defensive. And there were other guys that were even worse than I was. And I went out of there, and I found a man who was experimenting, you know, to cure this ulceration. His name was Wortel. And I was walking out of the hospital. They kicked me out, you know. I wouldn't give up the weapons, get the hell out of here. And I left. And I was looking for my unit, and I saw this sign, and it said, Wortel's Bird Sanctuary. And there was a bunch of white, beautiful white tents. And I said, who's Wortel? And there was a guy there, and he had a half a sailor outfit and half a marine outfit. And he said, I'm Wortel. He said, welcome. He said, what's your problem? And I told him, I got kicked out of the hospital. Oh, he said, well, he said, look at these guys. They all got kicked out of the hospital. There's a bunch of guys in there, all half psycho. And he said, what have you got? And he raised my pants and he looked at my legs and he said, oh, he said, I can help you with that if you want to stay here. So I said, sure, you know, what do you do here? He said, I do experimenting. He said, I'm not a doctor, I'm just a corpsman. But they've let me experiment here. Would you like me to try some things on you? Anyway, cutting through, you know, I was there with Wortel for a couple of weeks, and he pretty much fixed me up. You know, he cleared the whole thing up, and he said, there's no need for amputation. And I can tell you this, that hospital was a pig pen, the one I was in. Later on, Wortel developed some medicine that could take care of the ulceration. I mean, you know, it was effective. And the guy that ran the hospital, Commodore, took credit for it. He got a Legion of Merit. And Wortel got a quick trip to New Zealand, you know, to a psych ward. He actually cracked up, you know, because, again, like Carlson, you know, he had been outranked and and had been kicked out of his job. The jealousy and the nitpicking and the backbiting that existed against the Raiders is not from the rank and file of the regular Marines, because they really, I mean, I feel from what they said to us, you know, when we got together, that they really admire the work we were doing. It was a very high rank, you know, the generals and the admirals that were sniping at Carlson, but the Marines always treated us great, and they thanked us for the work we were doing and the fact that we'd gone out there. When we came back, I remember talking to some of the Marines from, I think it was the 7th Regiment, who were holding the line, and when we came through their lines, they actually looked at us as though we were seeing ghosts. We were the skinniest, most beat up, dirty, bedraggled bunch that they said that they had ever seen. They couldn't believe it. One of the guys said, you guys look like ghosts coming through the line. You look like skeletons. And we'd been living on rice for 30 days and tea. And when we came through, that Marine regiment just ran us right through their chow line. They happened, as we were coming in, they were getting ready to eat, and they just made way for us. They said, hey, Raiders, come on, eat. And boy, did we pig out. Their food just tasted like it was the greatest food that ever existed. It was regular Marine food. But they just stood aside and just fed us, you know, feed these guys. And then they couldn't stop talking to us. How was it back there? And gee, did you guys see a lot of chaps? And gosh, we heard about what you were doing. And it was never the rank and file Marines that had that feeling. After the war, I had been writing. I had begun writing, and there was a great demand for war stories in the magazines in New York. And I was writing a lot about the Raiders. I wrote that story about Lualoa. That's why I remembered Dad, and I wrote some stories about Bougainville and all that, and some of the guys that I knew. And because I was doing research all the time, I was aware of what was happening with Carlson. Carlson started to run for Congress. But he had been very badly wounded. He was physically in terrible condition by that time. I think he was about 48, 49. And he had been urged to run for Congress and had agreed to do it. But he had been wounded very badly. I think it was in Saipan. what happened was, you know, typical of Carlson, a young PFC was hit during the fighting, and Carlson was just an observer. They never gave him a command anymore. They just hated him too much. Like I said, they gave him another Navy Cross and a Legion of Merit and a whole bunch of stuff, but no command of his own. And Carlson was there as an observer, and some young boy, 19, got hit. Great big kid. Carlson ran out. I mean, here he was. He was a bird colonel. He ran out there, picked the kid up, threw him on his shoulder, and started running back into the lines with him. And at that point, an enemy automatic weapon opened up on him, the same one, I guess, that had hit the boy and hit Carlson, got him, I guess, in the shoulder or in the back. And as late as 1947 or whenever it was that he died, he had not fully recovered from that. He just couldn't shake it. You know, physically, he had burned himself out in this raider effort, totally burned himself up physically, and he couldn't shake it. And he had a heart attack, and then another one, and he went. He says that he said to his wife, "I've broken down like the old one-horse shay." And shortly after he died, he would have been a wonderful senator, I think. I was devastated. Everybody was. Every guy that had served under him was devastated by his death. He was such a wonderful man. And even today, when I went to Korea, I was an officer then. And I remember I went to visit a Marine unit, and there was this Marine warrant officer of the Marines, and he was talking to some NCOs there, and he was talking all about, "Oh, the Raiders this and the Raiders that, they didn't do anything," and blah, 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 blah. And I said to the guy, I said, "You know, I was a Raider with Carlson." He said, "Oh, yeah, Carlson. Well, he was a pinko, wasn't he?" At that point, I knocked him over a table. I had a Jeep out there, and I said to my sergeant, "Let's get the hell out of here." But, I mean, even as late as Korea, you had blabbermouths like that who were saying that Carlson was a communist. It's a damn lie. The media, of course, loves to sensationalize anything, you know. And I remember when we were in training at Jack's Farm, some guy was circulating a story, you know. He had a newspaper, and he was showing us the newspaper, and there was a whole feature in it. Some guy had visited the camp while we were training, and he had written about these raiders. They were all massive, powerful men, and when we were in training, you know, there was a guy that stood next to us and threw animal blood in our faces so that we could smell the blood and get used to killing and all that, which, you know, it's ridiculous, you know. El Flores, my buddy that I keep mentioning, was 5'4" tall. I mean, he was a little guy. Admittedly, he was the littlest guy in the Raiders. And some energetic sergeant, I said, you know, you always got a jerk in every outfit. Some sergeant decided he was too small and he had to kick Al out of the Raiders. Al was incensed, you know, and he went to see Colonel Carlson, because you could always go see Carlson about anything. And he said, "Colonel, they're trying to get rid of me." And he said, "Who?" And he said, "Well, the sergeant says I'm too little and all that." He said, "You want to stay in the Raiders?" "Yes, sir." He said, "You still willing to go on with us?" "Yes, sir." And he said, "I'll carry a BAR to show that SOB how little I am." The colonel said, "You don't have to." He said, "Just tell him I said to leave you alone." And Al stayed in, and on Guadalcanal, he won a Silver Star, which is, I think, the third or fourth highest decoration we give. When Al was dying of cancer in the Veterans Hospital here at Wadsworth, my wife and I went to visit him. And, you know, his family was there. And he was, in his mind, was reliving the old days. He's lying there in bed with his tubes and all that. And he's reliving the old days. And he said, "Do you remember when we did this? Remember how we went through the lines?" He said, "Remember when you had to go back and I took you through the Japanese lines and Yeah, I remember. And then he took my arm like this and he said, "We must have been crazy, Bill." And then he turned and said to my wife, "We must have been crazy." Yeah. He died 2 days later. But he was a great guy. And all of those guys were great guys. I remember another buddy of mine, Jack Johnstone, and just before we left for Guadalcanal, he was sharpening his gung-ho knife. You know, we had these big knives we call gung-ho knives, sharpening it, and he sliced his hand, and he was told he couldn't go on the campaign. And he came to us, and he started crying because he couldn't go with us. And not too long after that, in about the middle of the campaign in Guadalcanal, he showed up, and he was all still bandaged. But oh, he was so happy. "Hey, I told you guys I'd catch up with you, didn't I? You're not going to go off by yourselves," and all that. That was the kind of spirit that existed among those men. Great guys. You know, at the time, we didn't evaluate one another, but Carlson trained us so well, in my view, and in the view of others, too, that actually, far from being a suicide outfit, I mean, in my mind, I mean, it seems like it should have been a suicide outfit, but actually, we were so well trained that I think we have fewer casualties than the average Marine unit did. I think the enemy is the one that had the big casualties when we met, not us. And I'm not boasting that was just good training and the heightened instincts and all that. Our attitude always was that being in the Raider Battalion was the safest place to be, you know, because of the tremendous firepower, because of the guys around you that knew what they were doing, and because of the training that Carlson had given us. We always felt very safe, and I think that we had relatively low casualty figures compared to regular Marine outfits. I think that we lost more of the Raiders in conventional fighting on Iwo Jima than we did, you know, in all the Guadalcanal and all the other Raider campaigns for that matter. I mean, you know, a lot of the Raiders bought the farm on that island. And from the time we went in, you know, we just got blasted with artillery and mortar fire on the beach and all that. And I kept hearing, "Hey, you hear what happened to this guy and that guy? And oh, Brownie got hit by artillery and he lost his leg up to here and he bled to death," and that kind of stuff. Brownie was one of our Raiders, I remember, a good guy, but you have no defense against an artillery shell coming in on you. All the training in the world is not going to do you a damn bit of good then. And that's what happened to a lot of the old Raiders. They ended up there. Just like John Bassalone ended up there. That was a hell of a campaign. Sometime after the war, my buddy El Flores, who had been in the Raiders with me, and another guy came over to me, and they told me that they were having a Raider convention in Santa Monica. And I had not heard anything about anything like that, but anyway, they wanted me to go with them, and I did, and there's all these guys. We're still pretty young. All of these guys are boozing it up, you know, and telling each other war stories and all that. And it was that whole bunch of old Raiders, except that now they were incorporating, you know, all the four Raider battalions, and they call themselves the U.S. Marine Raider Association. I think that was the name they had at that time, too. And I saw a lot of the guys that I had not seen in years. And it was really great. You know, I've never been a big joiner. But being around those guys was really terrific because that had been a big experience in my life. I was 23 when I got out of the service. So, and now, I guess we were like, it was after Korea, yeah. So it must have been in the 55 or something like that. And I hadn't seen those guys in all that time, and it was just great. And so I joined the Raider Association just so I could see them. And I'm still a member, and we get together, and you can see that most of us are not exactly spring chickens anymore. But we still get in there and we still tell each other the same old war stories. And instead of being able to down a bottle of bourbon now, you know, we're lucky to get half a beer down, but it's still great seeing those guys. I have to say that, except for when we have the conventions, or when some old raider calls me up, as one did recently, a buddy of mine, Sal Germanko, who was on a machine gun with me. Unless something like that happens, I don't really think about it very much. But when I get the Raider patch, which is our, you know, official association paper, I, no matter what I'm doing, I stop and I read the whole damn thing, and remember a little bit about it. But you know, it comes out 3 times a year, I think. And other than that, you know, life goes on. You don't really think, you don't sit around dwelling on it, you know, the charges of the Light Brigade and all that sort of thing. Just most of these guys came out and picked up their lives and had children and all that. And once in a while you think of the guys that didn't have that chance, you know, to continue their lives, who didn't marry and have children and have a normal existence, you know, the guys you left behind when they were 18 and 19 years old. But it's not something that we sit around thinking about all the time. We just have a kind of a sense of gratitude and camaraderie you know, some pride that we were even allowed to be a part of a group like that. I feel that. I feel privileged. There was a time when the Raiders were needed, and these guys were there. And later on, when they were no longer needed, you know, that was the end.
That was William Lansford. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for watching, and by doing so, honoring those who've served. This program was produced by Evergreen Podcasts and Documentary.tv. I'm your host, Ken Harbaugh. If you've enjoyed this episode, please comment, share, and subscribe below.
Guadalcanal had been invaded, and we were finally, we got an assignment to go into Guadalcanal and help, you know, the effort there. The Marines were very hard-pressed.
Near the coastline.
You know, they'd done a wonderful job, but, I mean, they were virtually isolated, too, fighting on nothing. So anyway, our assignment was to take... one of the admirals had gotten a bug, and he thought we should have another airport, you know, make another airfield at a place called Iola Point. Iola Point. And we were to, the Raiders were to escort some Army engineer units and men from, I think it was the Americal Division,
General Vandegrift,
into Iola Point and guard them, you know, make a perimeter around them and guard them while the engineers dug another airfield.
And then
we went in, and, you know, it was a bust. The place was a swamp. The high command had not really known anything about it. It was just a bug somebody had. So there we were, you know, the poor Army guys had nowhere to go and nothing to do, and neither do we. And then at that point, word came in that a Japanese, a well-known Japanese regiment had landed some miles up from us, from where we were, and were marching to reinforce the Japanese who wanted to retake Henderson Field in Guadalcanal, which, as you know, was what the fighting was all about. And Carlson was called in to talk with Vandegrift, I think, who said...
Carlson returned from conferring with the Marines there around Henderson Field and said that we had an assignment to knock out this Japanese regiment.
Okay.
That's what we were going to do. So
the Japanese had, you know, there had been some ferocious fighting there, and, you know, the Marines were... The Japanese Navy came in and just blew up the whole place over and over and over again. There was nothing that
we
could do to stop them.
And the rest of the Raiders.
And the Marines there were very hard pressed.
And followed the Japanese all the way from
the Raiders
to Henderson Field, and just kept chopping and chopping and chopping at them. And it was probably I guess along with Macon Island is probably the job
exemplified
the kind of work.
Yeah, the Marines were very hard pressed,
and Carlson
we landed with the, you know, we escorted these Army troops in. They were supposed to make an air.
As soon as they started to cross the river with their equipment up, we'd hit them, bango, and
maybe it's a helicopter going around.
Try that one more time. The Marines being hard pressed.
Yeah, the Marines were very hard pressed. The regular troops were very hard pressed, and around, you know, defending Henderson Field, the Japanese were determined to take it back. And they kept constant, since the Japanese had naval superiority in the area, they would come in and shell the Marines, you know, all night long, and shell Henderson Field, and, you know, it was pretty bad for those guys.
It gave tremendous mobility and firepower to the Marine squads, and it's used today. The other one was extensive use of walkie-talkie radios by which the officers were able to keep, you know, the company officers were able to communicate with each other and coordinate their attacks. And consequently, we had a lot of mobility that the Japanese didn't have. And, you know, it was a whole regiment, and we were just working in teams of maybe one or two companies at the most. And we were able to hit them and then disappear into the jungle, which must have galled the Japanese because they were supposed to be the great jungle fighters. And we would hit them and disappear into the jungle, and then a few hours later, locate them and hit them again. And the result was that after 30 days of following and hitting these poor guys, the regiment ceased to exist. You know, when it arrived at its destination, it was useless. It was, and my understanding is that the colonel burned his flag and shot himself, and that was the end of that effort. And General Twining, who at that time was a colonel and was the chief planner for Vandegrift and the Guadalcanal campaign, wrote in his book, I think it's called No Bended Knee, I think the book, that it was the most perfectly executed campaign of the entire Guadalcanal fight, of the entire Guadalcanal campaign. And Carlson did that. We were able to kill, you know, literally hundreds of Japanese and lose only, you know, a fraction of that in raiders. I think in one time, I think we knocked off about 50 of them at Asamana, and we lost 3 raiders there, as I recall. But the odds were always that way, you know. The Japanese were not, they didn't expect that Americans would be able to do that. And I think if nothing else justifies what Carlson's philosophy, that does. I'm not saying it very well. But I mean, I think that justifies a whole raider effort right there. That, and of course, Edson, the first raiders, did a magnificent job on what they call Edson's Ridge, you know, defending Guadalcanal one night. He won the Medal of Honor for that. So, you know, the first raiders, you can't take it away from them either. They were doing a great job. And later on, the other raider battalions, the 3rd and the 4th, one of them was headed by Jimmy Roosevelt, did a marvelous job too. The main thing was that you had to have, I think you had to have a lot of stamina. You had to be able to live on nothing. During that 30-day raid behind the Japanese lines, we literally lived on rice and tea and a little bit of bacon occasionally. That was our whole diet during that period. Carlson had developed a system of airdropping food to us. But, you know, airdropping was a primitive thing at that time, and half the time I think the Japanese got our food more than we did. But we would cook in our helmets, I remember. Start a little fire and put rice and water in our helmet, and if you had any bacon, you'd break up little pieces and drop it in there. And sometimes we had salt and sometimes we didn't. Each man was issued every few days, I can't remember how often, each raider was issued as much rice as he could hold in his sock up to the heel. And then we would tie the sock on our belt, I remember, and as much tea as you could, you know, hold up to the middle of the foot of the sock, you know, the foot section. And that's what we lived on, tea and rice. It wasn't a great diet.
Do you recall when you were doing this, these primitive conditions you're living in, and you're chasing these Japanese guys, were you functioning on your instinct from the training? Did you ever think, you know, how did I wind up here? You know, what do you recall your thoughts were?
Well, you know, everybody venerated Carlson, but I can tell you, and it was the same thing with Edson, you know, that in the middle of that campaign, you had some crybabies, you know, as you always do anywhere, who would say, oh, the Carlson is crazy, they were right, why did we ever come out with them? And all we'd say to him, shut up, you know. But the guys, you know, 99.9% of the guys just did their job and didn't complain about it. Carlson was everywhere. I can't tell you. He must have been at that time around, let's see, 1942. He died in 47, I think, and he was about, I think it was 47, and at that time he was 49 years old. So that's 5 years. So he must have been 44 years old. And he was like a young kid. I mean, he was just everywhere. And he suffered too. You know, his feet were rotting, and he was eating the same food we were, and he had to maintain discipline at a time when a lot of us wish we were somewhere else. I remember one time when he addressed us, because even in the field he had these little gung-ho meetings, and he said, "Boys, I know it's pretty tough, but look, somebody's been pilfering things. Some of the guys have been pilfering things. I know most of you wouldn't do that, but some have." He said, "Somebody stole my toothbrush, for one thing." He said, "Whoever it was, I want to announce to him now that he has pyrrhea, is it?" And he said, "But I want to tell you in all seriousness that if he is caught, if anybody's caught stealing from one of his mates," he said, "I will have him summarily shot right here." He said, "We'll just take him right over there to the edge of the jungle and he'll be shot. That's it." And there was no more stealing. You know, you always have a few bad apples. You can't get away from that. And he was always on the point. I remember one time when he was, I mean, he didn't need a point man. He was just rushing out there. And all of a sudden we heard some shooting up in front. And when we caught up, you know, because I told you I was a scout and a machine gunner, and when we caught up, Carlson was standing there with two dead Japanese. And then there was this guy, I think his name was Carpenter, who was sort of like a bodyguard to Carlson, because Carlson was busy with details and couldn't, you know, he didn't look after himself. You know, he's running around smoking this pipe and saying, "Do this and do that. You bring your company over there," and so forth. And Carpenter had been with him, and all of a sudden, a couple of Japanese soldiers popped up, and Carpenter had this submachine gun, you know, a Tommy gun, and he just opened up on him and blasted him. And the old man, you know, he did, "Oh, good work, son." He was not a very excitable man.
Tell me about the rest of when the Japanese made it to Henderson Field. They were basically, they were ineffective. What happened then?
Well, what was left of the Japanese regiment arrived at Henderson Field, they were, you know, they were demoralized and decimated, and the regiment was essentially destroyed. And as I said, you know, I heard later on that the colonel burned his flag, the regimental flag, and shot himself. And that was it. You know, they just were useless. They just scattered, and they never made the effort against they never were able to reinforce or make any effort against Henderson Field. And the Raiders were credited with having killed at least 400 and some known enemy casualties at a very, very, I forget how many we lost, like 15 or 20 guys. I may be wrong about that. I haven't checked the figures in a long time, but it was minimal.
Did the attitude of the Marines on Guadalcanal when you guys showed back up after this campaign change? You know, was there a feeling that the Raiders were serving a purpose?
The jealousy and the nitpicking and the backbiting that existed against the Raiders is not from the rank and file of the regular Marines. Because they really, I mean, I feel from what they said to us, you know, when we got together, that they really admire the work we were doing. It was a very high rank, you know, the generals and the admirals that were sniping at Carlson. But the Marines always treated us great, and they thanked us for the work we were doing and the fact that we'd gone out there. When we came back, I remember talking to some of the Marines from, I think it was the 7th Regiment, who were holding the line, and when we came through their lines, they actually looked at us as though we were seeing ghosts. We were the skinniest, most beat up, dirty, bedraggled bunch that they said that they had ever seen. They couldn't believe it. One of the guys said, "You guys look like ghosts coming through the line. You look like skeletons." And we'd been living on rice for 30 days and tea. And when we came through, that Marine regiment just ran us right through their chow line. They happened, as we were coming in, they were getting ready to eat, and they just made way for us. They said, "Hey, Raiders, come on, eat." And boy, did we pig out. Their food just tasted like it was the greatest food that ever existed. It was, and I just regular Marine food. But they just stood aside and just fed us, you know, feed these guys. And then they couldn't stop talking to us. How was it back there? And gee, did you guys see a lot of Japs? And gosh, and we heard about what you were doing. And it was never the rank and file Marines that had that feeling. In the beginning,
sorry, we need to change it. Hold on.